So next up, it's my pleasure to introduce our next keynote, Dave Demers. Dave, I had the pleasure of working with Dave very early in my career at a time when I was with an options trading firm here in town called O'Connor & Associates, and he was with a firm based in Santa Fe called The Prediction Company. This was mid-90s, unfortunately. It's been a while. But we worked together for about 8 years through that period. The Prediction Company developed a statistical arbitrage business that was part of the prop trading at O'Connor, and eventually was purchased by Swiss Bank and UBS through the O'Connor acquisitions, but then Prediction was also acquired by UBS, I believe, in its final stages. And that became a very large part of their prop activity, even after the UBS O'Connor component of those prop strategies was spun into the hedge fund business. Dave left in about 2000, if I remember right, and went to Paloma Partners, where he traded a captive strategy there for about 5 years, and then started Black Mesa Capital in Santa Fe, which ran an equity market neutral strategy for a number of years, which I was glad to be an investor in. And then he left after 2008 when Black Mesa did quite well, but was a source of funds for everything that wasn't doing very well, and went to SAC. And I'll let him comment on his SAC experience, because I think it's particularly fascinating, and I'm hoping you're going to explain the central book concept a little bit, maybe today. But the there are a couple of episodes that I think are really interesting that we lived through. One was the 2007 quant quake, but the other one is the 1998 episode. And I think both of those episodes are really relevant to what he's going to talk about today in terms of thinking about risk through time. So it's my pleasure, and please help me welcome Dave Demers.
Great, thanks, Peter. Thanks for inviting me here. I really appreciate it. I've been here a couple of times, never actually spoken. It's probably only fair since I've monetized a lot of R code. As I say in my bio, I've been using R since it was called S. And Doug, I saw you here today. Thanks for doing business. And you know, I know you had a choice, and Obama was available, and I'm glad that I got the invite instead. I'm probably a little bit cheaper here. In trying to figure out what to do, I don't really give very many talks. I do teach occasionally, so I'm used to standing up in front of a crowd of you know, fish-faced people trying to say something, but I haven't really given very many talks. So I asked Peter. He said, "Whatever you find interesting will probably be interesting to this crowd." So I didn't put up some alternative titles, but we came pretty close to quasi Monte Carlo sampling in HCL space to get maximum discrepancy color palettes. But it turns out people really know more than I do about color palettes, so that I actually spent a lot of months doing that, and it was kind of fun. But that's not today's talk. So you know, thought risk's fast and slow. I could put that out. It has nothing to do with Kahneman, but, you know, nice pithy title, and I could get that in the slot. And then, you know, 6 months ago, you know, that was there, and then I still had a lot of time to think about it. One of the things about risk, you know, you ask, what keeps you up at night? Well, that's a bad question for me if you ask my wife. You know, nothing keeps me up at night. She's really annoyed at me because, you know, time to go to bed, I go to sleep like soundly, so, but things do worry me. So, you know, that's part of what's going on. So I'm trying to think about over the years, I may not take myself too seriously, but I've always taken my fiduciary duties to my investors pretty seriously, and I don't want to lose their money. And so what can I do to avoid that? So that's part of the thinking behind here. Szilard yesterday described a keynote as sort of like a TED Talk, inspirational with big ideas. I've got 30 more minutes to figure that piece out. I think we might have the Emmanuel's talk as maybe the inspirational one of the day, unless somebody beats that. And I also, realized I had to go back at last night and change my slides completely because we had all the same memes, which is really cool for making talks today. You just go out, find the meme generator, put up a bunch of pithy things that you can talk about, and move on. If the thing goes well here at the end of the talk, you can thank me for it, and if not, you can tell Peter, and I don't really want to hear it. So what am I going to talk about? I'll talk a little bit about risk, how I think about it. I may tell some bedtime stories about quant quakes and liquidity crises. I say bedtime stories because every time I tell them, everybody falls asleep. They're not supposed to be bedtime stories, but we'll find out. And again, in maybe a little bit of deeper classification about what I've been thinking about over my career, and some of it I might recommend. Maybe I've learned something that's useful. And then why it really kind of matters, all of that's pretty obvious, So, risk. Let's parse the title a little bit. So what do I mean about risk? Here's some stuff. I don't really want to get into the deep philosophical issues about it. We can talk about it at Jack's. It's not really standard deviation, but in a lot of ways, that's suitable in a lot of circumstances. So, kind of guessing the conditional volatility based on stuff we know, that's interesting. There's a lot more to it, but as I'm fond of saying, you don't have to solve everybody's problem as long as you can just solve somebody's problem. If you can't solve anybody's problem, that's no good at all. So there's a lot more things that can be done and talked about and thought of in the risk space that I'm going to cover, even though I have a lot of slides, and who knows, I might cover a lot. We'll find out. And in a large sense of the world, again, we're using technical systems, computational systems, we're looking at data and making inferences, but this is not a big set of physical systems that we're actually measuring. There's a poker game going on, there's a whole bunch of people who are playing, some of them get up and leave and they change their strategy. As we saw in that HFT talk yesterday, we had this period of time and you actually saw serious behavioral changes. Now, I don't know what happened. I can hypothesize that they were losing money at this point in time and said, well, we better stop and change our model and figure out what we're doing or something. But you can, the game changes. The rules change. We went, Peter talked about the 90s, doing StatArb in the 90s. I would like to trade the 90s again. Ticks were an eighth. It cost somebody real money to step in front of you so you could get in the order book, and that was valuable. And the information in the order book was predictive enough that you could trade maybe 2% of a day's volume essentially for free. So we were able to print money for a couple of years, and then came decimalization and really sub-penny spreads, and now it does you no good to give the market a free option and see your offer. People can front run you for nothing, and so you have to change your game and change your strategy. So there's a lot of stuff out there that is not just numbers and inference, but you can get information and data from paying attention and figure out possibly some things to do. So I say fast and slow. What do I mean? I don't know. I mean, using real-time data, trying to discover what's happening exactly right now, and it might be something stressful, or maybe slow where I'm mostly not, and I say mostly here, we'll come back to that, mostly not using real-time data, trying to understand a broader sense of the state of the world. Now, we do know things about factor exposures and risks like that are handled in a, you know, a BARA type framework, and we can run a lot of systems and think about things like that. So I'm not going to talk about that. I'm talking about like state changes and regime modeling, which a lot of people think about, a lot of people talk about, a lot of people make some claims about. I haven't really seen a lot of good stuff there, but we can think of sort of different states of the world. Whether we're talking about fear and greed, you can just kind of look that up. CNN Money has a fear and greed index. This is about a week ago. It's now, I think, down around 45 or something. You know, I think they do publish details about issues that go into that. And, you know, that's kind of interesting. So Peter suggested I might say something about BSAC experience. I wasn't really going to, but so I did several things there, one of which was run the center book, and that was, as is rumored, large and successful. But I also did spend a lot of time on risk, simply because, again, I'm worried about avoiding losing money. I'm going to make money, but you know, we want to not fritter it away if we can keep from doing that. So I build a bunch of little things, and some of that are in what I'm talking about today, that was basically a dashboard on risk signals, and would send out this morning little blurb that first just went to Steve, and then it went to Steve and Phil, the head trader, and then everybody started asking for it. And so that it was a little morning comment, and that was pretty cool. I don't think anybody took action based on it. So, you know, if you're computing things and looking at information and it does not affect any action, then it's in the category of entertainment. Maybe you enjoy looking at it, but, you know, things really should be actionable. But I think it was. But, you know, I'm still in shock over the QuantQuake. We'll get that again. And in 2010, when I went there, it was fresh in my memory. So I'm fighting the last war. How can I detect the next serious crisis? Well, we haven't had one. So, I mean, we had a couple of little things, flash crashes and sequester, but, you know, it's all been pretty smooth. So, you know, hey, sell vol, do a carry trade, you know, everybody's happy. You know, I'll make the claim that we can identify regimes ex post. Obviously, that's a tautology. We look back at history and we can say, you know, the market is in a state. We can put classifications on those, two or more, you know, because otherwise, if it's just one state, that's kind of boring. But NBER labels recessions. They don't do it quite in real time. They look back and say, oh, a recession started back then. And so we can look back and see when the official recession was. We can look at, you know, again, fear and greed, risk on, risk off, alpha seeking, liquidity seeking, you know, three state kinds of state of the world is often interesting too, where it's, you know, hot, cold, or neutral. So big question, can we identify anything that leads to some meaningful prediction about the future based on our guess of the current market state? So maybe. I don't know, some stats sort of work. We'll see some problems with it. We also want to calibrate, right? So we see things. It's a bunny, right? Well, no, it's a cloud. It's not a bunny. So we see things even when things aren't there. So especially in a situation of sparse data, if we're looking at recessions, for example, they don't happen all that often, you know, 7 years, kind of a thing. So over a long history, You don't have a lot of events. You don't have a lot of statistics. It's kind of difficult to avoid getting caught up in data mining of the bad kind. But there's stuff we can just look up. So I threw a bunch of things in. At Bloomberg, they've got FCON, looks at financial conditions. You can see what liquidity looks like in the repo market. There's a bunch of other stuff. Implied vol is potentially interesting. Implied correlation is potentially interesting. If we go out, the IMF has a set of systematic risk indicators. There's lots of stuff on FRED. OFR had a report in their first report in 2012. They had a list of things that they liked looking at for systematic risk. There's something that's not on here. I used to always also look at the Baltic Dry Index. Probably a lot of you look at that. You do have to pay attention to the supply side of that because ships coming online and being scrapped is sort of lumpy, but it does give you a good idea of demand that may be preceding economic activity. There's a whole bunch of stuff. So here's an example on the ECB. They've got a statistical data warehouse. There's one page on that is their risk dashboard, which drills down into seven different categories, which each have a whole bunch of stuff in there. And, so you can maybe kind of look things up. But again, so what? We can look some things up. We'd really like to understand what they mean. There's lots of data. We just saw in a talk at the Lightning session, earlier, a couple of talks, there's data and there's information, and those are not the same thing. What we'd like to is extract some information out of that and then develop insights. I wish I had that exact slide, because that's even better than what I have here. So, so we might want to try to forecast change of state. So we could go back with some history, make some things up, say, here's some states, identify them, and then look at some data and say, here's something that is correlated or predictive with state change. Okay, cool. So there's lots of stuff. This is, Hal White was on my PhD committee, and it's one of my favorite quotes of his, 30 days in the lab saves you 3 hours in the library. Persistent theme here is we've got a problem. Other people have had that problem. Tools have been around for a long time to solve that problem. It's probably been solved, so let's go find best practice. We're all really smart. We can go roll up our sleeves and do the work, but why not let somebody else solve it and lever their work? So that's something that I'm a pretty big fan of. So there's lots of studies on recession modeling. Blah, blah, blah. So we can try something. Term spread, this is a good one. So look at the difference between 10-year and 3-month since 1982, which is when the series starts at FRED. It's 3 for 3, no false positives, no false negatives, but it's only 3 for 3. There's only been 3 recessions. So, and deep down, when it goes negative, that predicts a recession, or it precedes a recession at least. Why is the threshold 0? Is that just because of the artifact of a sign change, so we notice it? It's a simple hack. It's kind of intuitive. It's a one-parameter thing, though, so maybe we can sweep the parameter and look at ROC curves on the classification that we get or whatever, but then we're starting to sweep parameters, and so now we're fishing for more and more stuff, and who knows? But, this might be useful. And by the way, this is up to about a week ago, or a couple of months ago. So right now it says no recession, okay. So if you believe this indicator, we still have a ways to go. So I'm not gonna go through anything more in detail on this stuff, but you have an idea, you get some data, you do some stats, you guess causality, which I guess is modeling. And again, back to kind of a theme which I'm going to talk about, which is probably going to be obvious, and you're going to get bored hearing me talk about it, and I don't actually have an answer because you have to figure it out for yourself, but what's your policy? What does it mean if you have this stuff? What do you have to do if you find out some information? those are important, and you don't always know. So you can do a bunch of stuff. And, you know, it looks like maybe there's some potential for regime modeling. One of the things you do have to think about in your policy thoughts is what's the cost of being wrong? You know, it's kind of bigly victories if you're right, but, you know, if you're wrong, your false positives lead you to overhedge. You're buying way too much insurance. And, you know, false negatives, you know, you're betting too much when you shouldn't be even playing the game. So you have to make those trade-offs. And again, everybody's situation's different, so thank God I don't have to answer anybody's questions for them. They can just do it themselves, I hope. So there's stuff we can look up. We can also think about looking up other stuff, like processes and things that people have thought about. We can also think about looking at what the market is telling us via market data. There's a couple of things here that I like personally, and the OFR likes absorption ratio. I first heard Chrisman present this actually a long, long time ago. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Who's familiar with absorption ratio? Anybody? A couple of people. Okay, I'll go into it a little bit more. And so there's some things that, you know, we can do based upon data that we can pull out and do a light bit of processing on that may also help us, as opposed to just looking up indicators that other people have figured out already. Absorption ratio, the concept here is how much of the variance is explained in the first and principal components of your covariance. So generally, compare a short window to a long window and make some claims. He makes a bunch of claims about what that, what sort of inferences that you can make from that. It's pretty cool, but you do have, again, a number of tweaks you need to do. You need to figure out, you know, what's n. It, you know, that seems kind of arbitrary how many. He chooses 20% of the total number of variables. And, you know, why not? If you're going to do a short window, long window, how do you pick those? You know, is it he generally works with daily data and looks at past 3 weeks and where you only have rank 15 in the first place. If you're on daily data versus like a one-year trail, but you can do a lot of other stuff with it. And what are you looking at? I mean, that matters. You can look at a set of assets, you can look at indices, which is, I think, is what his original work was on, asset classes. I personally like factor returns, where, you know, I construct and create my own beta factors, my own risk model, and I look at those returns and see what the true number of drivers are in that set of stuff. So that's my methodology. And let me see if I can get this to work. So I did something on the S&P 100 stocks last week, and I put it out on RPubs. So this is from 2007 to last week, where the purple line is the 252-day calculation of absorption ratio in the top 100 names in the S&P, where I think I'm using 20. I'm not sure which I'm using. Anyway, I could look it up. This is N. I don't remember what N is. And then the green line is the 3 weeks, and then the ratio is the blue line. And the claim is that very high level of the blue line indicates periods wherein things are not going to work out well. And he has some claims in his papers that it's actually pretty predictive. The significance of the purple line here is a high level of that indicates that over a relatively longer period of time, the market is being driven by only a very few number of factors. And consequently, we can think of the market as being somewhat fragile. And when that line is low, then there's more diversity in the number of drivers, and we can think of the market as being a little bit more robust. So the policy idea you might take from that is, if this is low, then weird crisis sorts of things like a 2% drop and or something that's not too terrible, but you might be able to shrug that off. Or if you start seeing a little flight to quality or flight to liquidity, you might not worry about it so much. But if that absorption ratio is pretty high, then you might be worried and say, maybe I should buy some insurance. And this is in DY graph. So you can kind of look at it in the crisis period. This is not really the best way to apply this, but we see, here on July 17th, 2008, we have a big spike, and then we have another spike up September 19th. Should be no surprise, but this is a three-week rolling thing that's going into this. The purple thing is still saying we're high, but not in crisis. Anyway, cool. That gave me right back. I was very clever and developed information theoretic measure based on information entropy, and then discovered that that's been done before, and there's a name for it. This isn't real. So this is the only code I'm going to show. This is not real R code. I mean, it'll run, but you wouldn't write the thing this way. But that just treat the eigenvalues of your covariance matrix like probabilities, so normalize them out, and then say what's the information entropy in that, and that kind of maps similarly. So here's a similar kind of thing. This is a 252-day window over that approximately same time period. Now, looking at a 250-day window of things, what are you really getting? You've got a kernel on 6 months ago, so this has got a big delay built into it. So it's not necessarily particularly predictive, but it might be, at least postdictive. It's nice to explain why you lost money and you didn't manage to prevent it. And we can see that, in 2008, it just plummets down to a very low number of degrees of freedom. We also see it really plummeting down in 2012, and we didn't really have a crisis. I mean, things were kind of funky for a little while, and now it looks pretty good. So I've got two indicators I've shown you. Actually, the AR one was okay as well. So, all of my indicators that I did in the last couple of weeks here for the purpose of this talk seem to say we're not really in that bad a state of the world. I'm still mostly in cash, but that's because that's what I do. Other thing you can do that's, in the similar vein, is you can do just a model fit, have your favorite model, factor model, and fit the model. Generally, we'd like high R-squareds because that means we're explaining a lot of the variance. But if we have a high R-squared, that means a lot of the variance is captured in our model, and there's not a lot of residual stuff, and the residual stuff is really where all the alpha is. So a high R-squared would be kind of a similar fragile state. How am I doing on time? I'm not really paying attention. Ooh, okay. And net, doing this 252-day average on daily values is not as interesting as doing it on one-minute bars over the course of a day, where you can get a daily value that is actually kind of interesting. And this is what we built at Black Mesa, which helped us get through some of the stuff fairly unscathed. There's also interesting stuff, like we talked a little bit about momentum, Ilya did, and Kent Daniel has a great paper, multiple papers actually, on momentum crashes. It's really interesting. I don't know if I can predict one, but the aftermath of a momentum crash is interesting and has some characteristics. And he had identified 6 momentum crashes in his paper, and we had a momentum crash last year. So cool, we have a new one to look at. And 6 out of 6 in sample produced a particular set of characteristics, and one out of one out of sample did as well. And one of the characteristics was market is up significantly in 6 to 12 months after the crash. So this little smiley face there should not be any inference as to my trading activity last year. But and then the other thing that kind of triggered a lot of the Black Mesa stuff was in 2006, the Amaranth liquidation. We saw that on Friday, which I think was the 15th of September, and as a shock in the market that was weird. It was a factor shock to the factors that we bet on. The market wasn't particularly weird, but cross-sectionally, it was really weird. We didn't know what had happened, but it was enormous. And we found out on Saturday that Amaranth had failed, and I happened to know a guy who worked in their equity group, so I called him up on Sunday, and I said, hey, we reverse engineered from the shock to through our impact model, and we think you might have liquidated your book. You know, were you about 5 to 10 billion? Did you blow that out on Friday? And he said, Dave, I can't tell you things like that, but you've always been a good guesser. So so what did that led us to think? You know, we've got some exposure to liquidation of peers who might hold the same stuff. And inevitably, that risk is there, because if we're smart and they're smart, and we're buying tails on one end and shorting tails on the other end, we're going to hold some of the same stuff on the long side and some of the same stuff together on the short side, but my shorts and their longs are not going to intersect and vice versa. That'll be very tiny. I don't have access to their short positions, but I do have access to their long positions. So I could look at the 13Fs of the usual suspects. It's slow data, it's quarterly. Some of them move slow, some of them move fast. Like SAC is useless in this because, you know, we were, you know, by the time even the 13F comes out, those holdings are gone. So look at the correlation of my long book with their long book, and in some measure of my overlap, which isn't, I mean, I say correlation, that's not a mathematical term in this slide. Look at the short book, my short book, against their long book, and balance that a little bit. And if those are approximately the same, then I'm looking at, you know, Oppenheimer or something. And if those are, you know, vastly different, then I'm looking at Third Point or, you know, somebody who might actually hold a lot of the same things for the same reasons that I'm holding them. It's really hard to get cross-asset linkages. So, you know, what we saw in the quant quake was a credit crisis that reflected in the equity market, primarily for liquidity reasons. That's the same thing that happened in 1998 that Peter mentioned, which is we had this long divergence in during the year of factors, basically. And we had LTCM come in, and one of the things that happened is LTCM was not an equity shop by any means, but the investors, D.E. Shaw, Paloma Partners, a bunch of other people, a lot of them had very large market neutral equity books and had to liquidate in order to cover the blow up. And so in fact, on this magic day in October of 1998, when in the predictors book, that's the one where we come back from lunch and we've just made a bunch of $1 million, that was the day that two things happened. And I talked to David Shaw himself, who told me this or confirmed this approximately, although he might have just been humoring me, that that's when Shaw shut down Strat 1, and that's the same day that the Fed did their surprise rate cut and bolstered the markets. And, you know, we basically made 1% a day for the rest of the year, so that was cool. But one of the cool things was Shaw's not playing in the same space that we are anymore, and so, you know, we're wolves against sheep instead of wolves against other wolves. So that's a good place to be. So the cross-asset linkage piece actually was in my mind from 1998. All of this revolves around you know, when do you have this feeling? Right? So things are happening. What's typical? Huh, that's odd. That's probably the basis for most valuable scientific inquiry, right? You're doing some exploratory analysis and you see something weird and you follow it up. I'd like to think that it's all about, you know, making hypotheses and testing and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, usually you're just finding something when you're playing with your data. So the 1998 concept about cross-asset linkages was in my mind because I knew that equities were also subject to shocks in other markets. I didn't know how because you don't know who the players are and what they hold, and maybe some people do. I bet some of the primes have better view on that, but they don't tell me. So let me check my notes. So, actually keeping on good track here. So what's kind of, you know, the point? As I just said, I'll reiterate, are things typical? Is activity typical? Is sort of market state kind of, and when is it not typical? There's a lot of things you can look at that will just sort of tell you, and so I would recommend building an early warning system. It would be great if there was one out there. Maybe some of these, you know, FCON on Bloomberg will work. I don't know if that's good enough. Is this concept of market fragility worthwhile? I think it is. Again, we have long time horizons between events, so we don't really have a lot of ability to, you know, backtest anything, but there's theory, so that's good. And you know, although, again, you can always make up a story, even if you don't have theory. Recessions are interesting because, again, ex post, looking back at recessions, we can make some statements about asset returns and risk during recessions and not during recessions. So if we can identify earlier than NBER that we are in recession, or if we can even better predict that we're going to be in recession, we can take some actions on that. And it's not just entertainment, it's real actions that can help us manage our risk and make good bets, and that's what the game's all about. In fact, I'll make a strong claim, not a strong claim, nobody's really gonna dispute this, that it's all risk management, right? It's which risk do you want? And so you get rid of the ones you don't want, you take the ones you do want. So, anyway, so I talked about the QuantQuake already. I mean, I don't know how many of you were actively trading. My book was about $3.5 billion going into August of 06. And we, again, had detected some things that got us to delever sooner than the rest of the world. I wasn't patient zero, and I don't think I contributed a lot because I delevered much too slowly. As it turned out, that it would have been better for me to have just slammed it out the week before when I started and just been done and then just watch everybody else do things. And there's an issue here, you know, so we've got the two states, dash to cash versus dash to trash. Beyond that, there's two kinds of sort of flights that show up. There's a, maybe even three. I mean, there's the flight to quality where you just kind of delever by moving into better stuff. And you can watch that, and that's sort of secular and it's expensive if you're wrong on it, and you know, you can just kind of follow that along. But 2008, we saw kind of a flight to liquidity really fast because of the deeper concerns about solvency. So, you know, we again need to worry about, are we detecting just a dash to liquidity or quality that's not a solvency crisis, where what's happening there is, you know, hey, you're a market maker. I've been a market maker, not really, but, you know, I'm always shortfall all the time. So same thing, more or less. Blow your spreads out, collect, and the spreads come back. Right. So the quant quake was very short, punctuated. I believe that approximately $500 billion of market neutral equity book was liquidated over the course of about a week. And I calibrated my system to handle 50, because we saw Amaranth was 5. I figured 10 times that would be something that we'd see. And so once I saw stuff that said, hey, it's not going to be 50, let's be gone. So I don't have too much time left. So we want to kind of avoid that. And again, trading records show stuff that we can kind of classify. And we've seen really weird incidences like flash crashes and things that are clearly abnormal trading, where people are not out trading in order to follow their investment protocol, but they're trading for risk or liquidity reasons. And can happen a long time. So you can just kind of look at some things along a number of dimensions and track those. I'll just talk to beta. For example, I say beta there. You know, normally if the market's up, the Russell will be beating the NASDAQ, which will be beating the S&P, which will be beating the Dow. And if it's down, you know, it's kind of the other way around. What if this is sloped the other way? Is that interesting? Yes, it's interesting. Okay. So there's a bunch of other things you can look at. You could also look at something like a VPIN on instruments that people use for hedging or liquidity purposes, like E-minis. You know, that is a pretty valuable thing when you see the trading behavior. It doesn't have to be VPIN, but something indicating vastly distorted trading behavior in those instruments. That tells you something's up. Can you similarly figure out if HFT guys are doing something toxic? Can we game them? That's always fun. Another Kritzman thing is turbulence, which is basically current state of the world compared to sort of the Z-scored version of it across your dimensions. So if you've got 10 things you're looking at, the Mahalanobis distance of that, which is basically normalize everything and take the Euclidean distance. The degrees of freedom thing, again, you can apply that to short-term data. There's statistical process control, runs tests are interesting as well. There's also the fact that high-frequency data filters can, in fact, predict longer horizon vol. I'm not going to tell you more about that now. Here's a little turbulence example in the quant quake. So this spike, big spike to the left there where it pops up over 4. This is in sort of normalized standard deviation type terms. It's not a normal distribution, but it's 4 standard deviations. So that's interesting, and that's the end of July. So that got us alerted, among other things, although if you go out and look at this whole thing, you'll see that there's a lot of places where it's that big. So this is actually not the whole story, but it's an illustrative story. So that got us to thinking about things. We had also seen something earlier in the year, which was two things, actually. SocGen, Kerfeel blowing his book out, and the bear stuff that happened. So there was a lot of reasons to be worried, and we were also looking at 1 minute bars on our own factors and doing some statistics on that, which was really the major thing. And I don't have the data to reproduce that, so I'm not going to show you what it looks like, but it's actually pretty easy. I was going to tell a story. I don't have very many minutes, so I'm not going to tell this story. It's more deeper into what I just said. So, you don't want to meet this guy, right? So, So there's lots of things that can be done to observe and understand what the state of the world is in either a really larger regime type context or what's happening right this very minute. Now, what's happening right this very minute, some people, like again in the quant quake, The BGI spawn had, you know, a lot of market neutral type books, and they took a big hit as well, but they didn't do anything and they were fine. Why? Not a lot of leverage and too big to take corrective action immediately. You know, I'm running 7-to-1 leverage, so I can't take a margin call. You know, there's a drawdown limit that I can't absorb that I thought I knew where it was, and it turned out I was wrong. But I was able to delever and salvage my investors' money and happily move on and put up, you know, top decile numbers and go out of business, as Peter said, because everybody took their money away because I had 30-day liquidity. Anyway, it was all for the good. So, you know, insurance is expensive. It's expensive in normal circumstances. It's even more when you need it. When you need it, it might not even be available. And you have to worry about counterparty risk, maybe even. I don't know, you're buying some insurance where if the state of the world happens where you win, you can't collect. So you've got to look at that. All right, so I talked about doing a bunch of stuff, and I showed a couple of pictures that showed that I actually did some stuff. So in the spirit of levering other people, I've written some code. I've actually written a package that has not been released. It's mostly 95% written by Tony Plate, who many of you know, but I use the bmc.misc package for a lot of my work, and most of that's been subsumed by new and better stuff. I may never release a package, who knows, but there's a lot of stuff out there that's very useful, and most of the code for the things that I talked about is really easy. I mean, it's all, you know, this much code. Bottom line, the challenge is data management. Have you ever heard that before, right? Getting the data, understanding that it's clean, using it, you know, that's 95, I'll make up another number, 95% of the job, and doing some work on that is actually pretty trivial once you've got access to good, clean data. So, you know, give me the damn data, get out of the way, and there we go. So I don't have anything to share. I don't have any contact information on the slide. I'm pretty much not really affiliated with anybody right now, and I'm kind of mostly play tennis and guitar, and anyway, with my favorite TV dad. And then in the PDF, there's some more stuff, like links to things. So zip through some things you could do. Talked about black swans, in case anybody knows. I have a pet peeve about that, but we don't need to go down that path. We can talk about that. I didn't talk about sentiment. Here's some other things you could look at. Here's some papers you could look at. Anyway, I've never, never, never had anybody say this. All right. Any questions?